we can go on to chapter 16, the divine and demoniac nature. Mainly, actually, it's describing the demoniac nature. Because we've heard chapter 13, we all know what that's about. Chapter 14, the modes. Now we heard about the banyan tree. So what does it do to a person? What does it do to someone if they get caught up in this whole scene here in the material world? What does it do to them? They become demons. Demons are not very nice, as we'll see. Demon means like a dedicated materialist, staunch enthusiast for material life. So in the first three verses, Krishna describes the devotees, or the qualities of the devotees. So many nice qualities are there. And in many ways, they're qualities of the mode of goodness. They're divine qualities, very nice qualities. They'll help one advance in Krishna consciousness. Then in verse 4, Krishna begins to introduce the demoniac qualities. They're very nasty. Pride, arrogance, conceit, anger, harshness, ignorance. In verse 5, Krishna gives a little reassurance to Arjuna, don't worry. Maybe Arjuna was getting into anxiety. Am I a devotee or a demon? Don't worry, you're a devotee. You have these divine qualities in you. You know, there's a saying that in such a yuga, the demons and devotees, I forget exactly how it goes, it's something like they were living on different planets. In Treta Yuga, they are living in the same planets, but in different countries. In Dwapara Yuga, they are living in the same countries, but in different houses. But in Kali Yuga, the demon and devotee are living in the same body. The demon and the devotee are living in the same body. So, you know, that's why we find that sometimes it's a little difficult to really advance nicely in Krishna consciousness, and sometimes we become attracted to Maya. So it's because we have this in us. I'm not saying any of you are demons. You're not. You're great devotees. But there are traces of the demoniac, or when we say materialistic, we mean demoniac nature, anti-Krishna, sense gratification. So Krishna says then in verse 6, now I'm going to tell you all about the demons. And then he gives an extremely vivid description of the demons. Very vivid. They don't like cleanliness. You can't find cleanliness in them. You can't find proper behavior. You can't find truth. They have all sorts of strange understandings about what this material world is. They may think it's unreal, that there's no real foundation to it, that there's no God in control, that reproduction is the essential thing that we should really concern ourselves with. Just like, I mean, you can see it so clearly in Darwin's theory. Darwin's theory simply means the progress of sex life, basically. How to progress through sex life. Evolution, one species evolving birth after birth. So it's just following in this principle, thinking sex life to be so important, such an important principle. Then in verse 9, they're so bewildered, it's so crazy, that they actually, they willfully engage in activities which are horrible. and which are actually intended to destroy, like atomic bombs and things like this. It's completely crazy, completely mad. They take shelter of lust, verse 10. They're absorbed in pride, false prestige, even if they've got nothing to be proud of. Even if they're full of disqualifications, they'll be proud of something. They're attracted by the impermanent. Verses 11 and 12, as far as they're concerned, sense gratification is the goal of life. That's all. Eat, drink, and be merry. But what happens? As a result of that, they're in anxiety all the time. Because there's such intense competition. I want sense gratification and you want it. So we compete. One of us gets the sense gratification, the other doesn't. So much anxiety is there. Anyways, going on like this, the mentality of the classic demon is expressed in verses 13 and 15. So much wealth do I have today, I'll gain more according to my schemes. So much is mine now, it'll increase in the future more and more. He is my enemy and I've killed him. I'll kill my other enemies. I'm the lord of everything. I'm the enjoyer. I'm perfect. I'm powerful and happy. Very nice. This is the mentality of the demon. But what happens? Verse 16 explains. They go to hell. They fall down. Krishna explains in verse 19 that such demoniac people I perpetually cast into the ocean of material existence. One devotee, when Srila Prabhupada visited South Africa, one devotee asked Prabhupada, is it that everyone will go back to Godhead sooner or later? What do you think Prabhupada answered? No. Prabhupada said no. You can stay here forever if you want. Whatever you want. If you want to stay, stay. Krishna will say fine. If you want to go back to Godhead, Krishna will say fine. Come. Whatever you want. Prabhupada said that if you tell Krishna, I want to go to hell. Maybe you wouldn't necessarily say exactly like that, but through your desires you showed that you were desiring hellish things. So indirectly you're saying, I want to go to hell. Then Krishna will say, okay, come on, let's go. And away you go. There you'll be in hell. And if you want to go back to Godhead, Krishna says, okay, let's go back to Godhead. So whatever you want. So if you're like a committed demon, as is being described here, you can stay here indefinitely until you decide that now I want to get out. So now I'll surrender until that time. Then Krishna will give you all help. Krishna is very kind in that way. So it's not that, you know, after so many umpteen zillion years, that Krishna is going to finally decide that all you guys who have, well, all the people who haven't gone back to Godhead are still committed to being demons, that he'll just rip them out of the material world and just send them back to Godhead anyway. No. That's another thing. Let us just quickly finish this chapter. Yeah, let's just quickly finish this chapter. So, what to be careful of, particularly, there are three things. Verse 21. Krishna says there are three things you have to be particularly careful of. Lust, anger, greed. We have to be particularly careful of those things. And how do you do that? You have to follow Shastra. In verse 23, Krishna makes the point that if you don't follow scripture, then you can't achieve anything worthwhile. You won't achieve perfection. You won't even achieve happiness. What to speak of the supreme destination? Then verse 24, the last verse in the chapter. You have to understand what to do. How? Through scripture. And then you can systematically act in such a way that you are elevated. So that's good. We finished chapters 15 and 16. For tomorrow, read chapter 17 and begin reading chapter 18. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah. Begin reading chapter 18. We may go a little way into chapter 18. Any last question or comment?
Here we talk about lust, anger, and greed. Yes.
This is talking about material greed. Don't get confused. Okay. Now for your test, you've got to learn what's on this piece of paper. If you haven't got one, I have a couple more here. Make sure you get one. You have to learn about the banyan tree. You have to learn about the Purusha and Prakriti and all that. Then you have to learn your four verses. Then I also want you to learn from the second half of chapter 9 and the first half or third of chapter 10, how Krishna helps those, how Krishna relates with his devotees. That would particularly mean, as described in chapter 9, verse 22, verse 30 and 31, and then the Chatushloki Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 10, verses 8, 9, 10, and 11. How Krishna relates with his devotees. Or in other words, how bhakti yoga is really such a nice process, and it's even better than karma yoga, jnana yoga, and those other yogas. Okay, so we'll meet again tomorrow. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
You accept the condition. If you accept the condition, that means you become conditioned. So you accept the condition of goodness, it means you become conditioned by goodness. So we're accepting the conditions of the different modes, so we're called conditioned. Then verses 6, 7, and 8 describe how each one of the modes conditions us. With its conditions. So what are the conditions of the mode of goodness? It's purer, it's illuminating. And what happens when you come under the influence of that condition or you accept that condition? You achieve a sense of happiness and knowledge. It's very nice. But it's not that nice. It sounds quite good, very happy, knowledgeable. But look out. We become bound by goodness even. So our acharyas give a very interesting description of how one becomes conditioned by goodness or what is wrong with the mode of goodness. There are some things which are very wrong with the mode of goodness. One is that it's material, that's of course the main one. It's not natural for us. But Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says that there are two sins in goodness. Two sins. And what are those two sins? They're the very qualities that are referred to in this verse. Happiness and knowledge. In goodness. He says they are the two sins of the mode of goodness. And he says that attachment to knowledge creates ignorance. Now, Baladeva Vijayabhushan gives a more elaborate description. Part of it is, actually, Prabhupada in the second paragraph of the purport of verse 6 is basically explaining part of it. So he says that a person in the mode of goodness is aware that he's above passion and ignorance. He's naturally aware because he's in knowledge. So what happens? He becomes proud. He becomes proud of his position above passion and ignorance. Then a very interesting thing happens. He's appreciating that this knowledge and happiness that I have in goodness is very nice, and I don't want to lose them. So what does he do? He works in order to maintain them. He makes efforts to maintain his happiness. He makes efforts to maintain his knowledge. So what does that mean? He's falling into passion because he's making an effort. He's working. He's making an effort to keep these things. So he's actually falling into the mode of passion, because passion means you work in order to achieve a goal. So he says that the attachment, the happiness and knowledge, that's one thing. But the attachment that the person has, that is of the nature of Rajagun. Isn't that interesting? It's one thing to have the happiness and to have the knowledge, but when you become attached to it, that attachment is of the nature of the mode of passion. So therefore, if he doesn't become attached to the spiritual platform, he falls down. So these are the two sins of the mode of goodness: happiness and knowledge. Then, verse 7 is a fairly clear description. Mode of passion is born of desire, unlimited desires and longings. And because of it, one becomes bound to material fruit of activities. So the conditioning of goodness comes from the knowledge and happiness. The conditioning of passion comes from hankering and attachment. He's attached to two things: the fruit of the work and the work itself. Then verse 8 is describing the mode of ignorance. It covers everything. Mode of darkness covers everything. So Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur says that the first characteristic of the mode of ignorance is a lack of enthusiasm. Then verse 9. When one is conditioned by goodness, one becomes conditioned to happiness. One feels too satisfied to bother with Krishna consciousness. Why do I need to bother with Krishna consciousness? Life's great. I'm happy. I've got lots of knowledge. Very nice. When a person's in passion, one feels one is too busy to take an interest in Krishna consciousness. And when you're in ignorance, you're too dull or too crazy to take an interest. Then section C is recognizing superiority or supremacy of a mode within a person, or, in other words, to recognize what modes a person is under, or to recognize what modes you're under. It's probably a more practical sort of application. So verse 10 states that the modes compete. Of course, it's not exactly that the modes compete, but what is happening is that your karma is changing. Your karma is being administered basically via the modes. So your karma is changing. So at one point in time, because of your karma, you're more under the influence of goodness, but then your karma changes. Or, not exactly your karma changes, but you come onto like another part of your karma starts to manifest. And it's of a different nature. So then another mode will influence you. So in this way, one's position in the modes tends to change. Although one will have like a main mode that one is influenced by. So, what is the manifestation of goodness? Knowledge. So in other words, if a person is very knowledgeable, that indicates that they're considerably influenced by goodness. Now, if a person is mainly influenced by passion, how will you recognize that? Verse 12 explains. Great attachment, always interested in fruit of activity, intense endeavors, and great desires and hankerings. And if a person is predominantly influenced by ignorance, how will you recognize that? Darkness, inertia, madness. Hope none of you are mad. And illusion. Hope none of us are mad. So these are the four main characteristics of ignorance. Now later on in chapters 17 and 18, there are further elaborations. Like, for example, if a person is in the mode of goodness, what sort of food will they be mainly interested in eating? And so on and so forth. So many different subject matters according to the modes. But this is just a little introduction. So, person in goodness, characteristic is primarily knowledge. Passion, it's primarily great attachment, fruit of activity, intense endeavor, and great desire and hankering. And the basic characteristics shown by a person in ignorance, darkness, inertia, madness, and illusion. Then verses 14 to 18 are describing actions and death for persons in the different modes. So verses 14 to 15 are describing death. If a person dies in the mode of goodness, that person will go to the higher planets. If a person dies in verse 15, if one dies in passion, then you'll take birth basically on the earthly planets, amongst those engaged in fruit of activities. It means basically this realm. And when one dies in ignorance, you take birth in the animal kingdom or hell. Animal kingdom means hell. Or some other type of hellish situation. Then actions. In the mode of goodness. Piety. With correct vision. And it leads to life in heaven. Where's that stated? That's stated in 18. Action in the mode of passion results in misery. Action in the mode of ignorance results in foolishness. Then going on to, that's 16. Then going on to 17. What develops from each mode? From the mode of goodness, what develops is real knowledge. From the mode of passion, what develops is greed. From the mode of ignorance, what develops is foolishness, madness, and illusion. Then 18 again talks about destination. Destination of one in the mode of goodness, heavenly planets. Mode of passion, earthly planets. Mode of ignorance, hell. So if you look at it mode by mode, in the mode of goodness, you can make a note of these things, because we're going to ask you about this in the test. In the mode of goodness, At the time of death, the person goes to heaven. The nature of the activities of a person in the mode of goodness, the nature is that they're very pure and pious. And what develops from the mode of goodness is real knowledge. So three headings: death, act, the nature of the actions, and what develops as a result. So in goodness, death, you go to heaven. The nature of the actions are pure and pious. And what develops from the mode of goodness? Real knowledge. Then again, the mode of passion, under three headings: death, you take birth on the earthly planets. The nature of the activities, they cause misery. And what develops? Greed. Then, mode of ignorance. Time of death, animal birth or hellish birth. The nature of the activities of the person in ignorance? Foolishness. And what develops from the mode of ignorance? Foolishness, madness, and illusion. Did you all get that? Okay. So now we can go on and transcend the modes. Verse 19 to verse 27. This is what we need to know, really, ultimately, how to transcend the modes. So, 19 and 20, describing the importance of understanding all this and knowing that we and Krishna are transcendental. So there's no other performer, Krishna says, than the modes. So if we understand all this and we know Krishna, then what do we achieve? Madbhava, my nature, spiritual nature, Krishna says. You become free from birth, death, old age, and disease, and you enjoy amrita, vimuktam ritam. Ashnute, you enjoy spiritual nectar. Then in verse 21, Krishna asks three very relevant questions. How can you recognize a person who's transcendental? What are his symptoms? How does he act? How does he behave? And how does he achieve the transcendental position? It's one thing knowing about it, but how do you get there? So, verses 22 to 25 describe the symptoms and the behavior. So, symptoms. He doesn't hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they're present, or long for them when they disappear. Unwavering and undisturbed through all the reactions of the material qualities, neutral, transcendental, knowing that the modes alone are active. Now, according to Prabhupada's purport, those are the symptoms, and everything from that point on refers more to the behavior. Basically, the symptoms go down about halfway through that translation. The last symptom is knowing that the modes alone are active. I mean, they actually sort of overlap to some extent, but in Prabhupada's purport in the second paragraph, he sort of makes this distinction between the first half of the verse, or the first half of the translation and the second half. So second half is more describing the behavior. Self-situated, looking on a lump of earth, a stone and a piece of gold with an equal eye, and so on and so forth. These are the activities or the behavior of a transcendental person. And verse 26 is answering the question, how does the person achieve that transcendental position? How? Engaging in full devotional service. This is a very famous verse indeed. Mam chiyo vyabhicharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samatityaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. One who engages in full devotional service, unfailing in all circumstances, at once transcends the modes of material nature and thus comes to the level of Brahman. Now this Brahman that Krishna is referring to here is one who engages in full devotional service, unfailing in all circumstances, at once transcends the modes of material nature and thus comes to the level of Brahman. Now this Brahman that Krishna is referring to here is not the same Brahman that Krishna was referring to in verse,
whatever it was, 2 or 3 or so. It's 3.
It's not the same Brahman. Just that the term Brahman is being used to describe both. The first, in verse 3, what is being called Brahman is Prakriti. But here in verse 26, what is being referred to is the Brahman effulgence of the Lord, or the that which is completely spiritual. It's not that if you engage in full devotional service, then you come to the level of Maya. No. You transcend Maya. You transcend the modes of the Prakriti, of the material nature, immediately, and come to the level of the spiritual Brahman. And then in verse 27, Krishna makes a very interesting statement, particularly in regard to people who are impersonalists and who think that Krishna has come from the impersonal Brahman. Krishna says that the impersonal Brahman has come from me. It's based on me, pratishtha aham. Pratishtha in this context means established, like a foundation. So the Brahman is established or founded on Krishna. And our acharyas make the point in regard to the statement, it's the constitutional position of ultimate happiness. They make an interesting point that when a person first engages in devotional service, very enthusiastically, something like what is described in verse 26, really getting into devotional service, then Krishna says that they come to the level of Brahman. So what do we notice when we first get into Krishna consciousness? We notice we become very happy. You don't actually realize Krishna, that there's Krishna standing in front of me, talking to me. You don't realize that. That may come in time. But initially you just feel blissful and your mind clears a bit like that. So, Jiva Goswami says that that the realization of the neophyte devotee of Krishna, that the devotee becomes happy and a little more clear-headed in the very early stages of Krishna consciousness, he says this is a type of Brahman realization. Because you're realizing Krishna, but you're not realizing Krishna in person completely and entering into your relationship with him. You know, as far as Krishna in person is concerned, it's rather vague. Just some happiness and, you know, like that. Any questions? Well, to become Krishna conscious, you have to transcend all the modes, including goodness. But having said that, considering that we are under the modes to a greater extent at this point,
of the modes, the mode from which you can most easily enter into Krishna consciousness is the mode of goodness. If you try to enter into Krishna consciousness from the mode of ignorance or the mode of passion, it's a lot more difficult. But the mode of goodness, because there's knowledge, it's illuminating like that, there's clear-headedness and purity, then it's like a stepping stone into the transcendental realm. It can be. Of course, if you become attached to the mode of goodness, then you'll fall down, as we've described. But if from the mode of goodness you then make efforts to get into Krishna consciousness, then relatively easily you can get into Krishna consciousness, actually. But from the mode of ignorance, to get into Krishna consciousness, it's very hard. Or the mode of passion, always disturbed by so many desires and anchorings and feelings and emotions. And, you know, it's like that. But it's not exactly that the mode of goodness and Krishna consciousness are synonymous. But when the mode of goodness becomes Krishnaized, then it's known as Shuddha-sattva, pure goodness. That doesn't mean it's just like a better version of the mode of goodness. It means it's something else. It's another state. It's another state, actually. But of all the material states, that which most resembles it is the mode of goodness, and that which is most closely related. Sorry, I missed the last part. Well, yes, but not exactly. See, there's more to that statement. More than meets the eye and more than has often met the eyes of most devotees. There are three types of pious activities. One is called Bhogan Mukhi. This is from Bhaktivedanta Thakur. Actually, Prabhupada, if you read the 22nd chapter of the Madhya Lila, where the process of devotional disservice is being described to Sanatana Goswami, Prabhupada quotes Bhaktivedanta Thakur, who gives these three types of pious activity. So first, or one at least, is Bhogan Mukhi Sukriti. Sukriti means pious activity, basically. But it's Bhogan Mukhi. The result of it is Bhog. You know what Bhog is? Sense gratification. So that means material pious activity. Helping the starving people, building hospitals, and all that. Simply on the material platform, but it's clearly in the mode of goodness. Then he says there's Mokshan Mukhi Sukriti. Pious activity, which is of the nature of liberation, and it produces a result, not actually of liberation, but it sort of helps you advance in the general direction of liberation. So Mokshan Mukhi Sukriti means like detachment, tolerance, peacefulness. These are pious qualities. They're conducive for liberation. They're conducive for liberation. Then there is Bhakti Unmukhi Sukriti. These are pious activities which are devotional by nature. And they produce as a result like an impetus towards Krishna consciousness. But they are devotional by nature. They're not material pious activities by nature. They're devotional by nature. So this means giving a donation to the devotees, helping devotees, taking prasad, sponsoring some Krishna conscious activity. It's pious, but it's actually of a devotional nature. Now you may not really know,
that yes, here are the devotees, and if I give money to them, I'll advance towards devotional service. You may not know. You may not have any idea. But the fact is that the nature of the activity, it's related to Krishna. Your awareness of that fact is irrelevant. But the fact is that it is related to Krishna. So the result that is produced is a result which brings you closer to Krishna. So it's that type of pious activity which brings a person to devotional service. Whereas bhogon mukhi sukriti, just plain material pious activity, won't help. Like, you know, there's one verse in the Bhagavatam in which I think Sukadeva or someone is reflecting about the cowherd boys, that here they are playing with Krishna. So they ask the question, or the Sanskrit is, Krita Punya Punja. What sort of pious activities did these boys perform in their previous lifetimes? So that does not mean that they gave a lot of charity to the hungry people and all that, and they helped the blind people and helped old ladies across the road. It doesn't mean that. It means they performed a lot of devotional or Krishna-related activity. They may not have known. Some they may have known, some they may not have known. Whether they knew or not doesn't really matter. But they performed that type of activity which is called pious. One last question, Mr. James.
Verse 17, what does Bhagavad Gita refer to?
Well, it would mean some real knowledge about the material world, basically. Because Prabhupada, the purport, is tending to apply it in terms of the person who's in the mode of goodness, but also influenced by Krishna consciousness. For such a person, it would mean real Krishna conscious knowledge would come. But if a person is actually simply in the mode of goodness, then they'll get some understanding, like Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur was saying, that, oh, I'm above passion and ignorance. He'll see it. He'll understand what is passion and ignorance. And he'll realize, yes, I'm above it. And then he'll feel happy. Oh, good. And he may even feel proud. This is what I mean. So I think we should end there. For tomorrow, so bear in mind what I said I was going to ask you questions about for the test and work on it. For tomorrow, please read chapters 15 and 16. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
The Supreme Person. And it begins with a description of this material world, a metaphorical type of description, in terms of it being like a tree. Not actually a tree, but a reflection of a tree. A reflection of the banyan tree.
So we've passed out these little notes, which they're analyzing all the different statements because they're through the first couple of verses and purports. It would take us a while to draw them out. So I just drew them out myself. If you don't have one of these, please come and get one. So, we've heard in the 13th chapter, there's a description of the material world, or not just the material world, but description of the situation here, material nature, the living being, the supersoul. And in the 13th chapter, Krishna said that the soul is entangled in the material nature because of the three modes. But in the 13th chapter,
There were no clear statements about the three modes, what they are, how they work. It was just stated that there are these three modes and the living beings are caught up in them. So then the 14th chapter, it was giving a fairly elaborate description of what these modes are. Krishna said at the beginning of the 14th chapter that it's very important to understand this knowledge. He said it's the very best knowledge. Because in order for us to become liberated or really come to the platform of pure devotional service, we have to learn how to disentangle ourselves from the material world, or in other words, from the three modes. Now in chapter 15, Krishna is giving a further elaboration about the material world and how we should relate to the material world. And he's describing it as a banyan tree, or not actually as a banyan tree, but as a reflection of a banyan tree. He says the root is up, the branches are down. Prabhupada asks the question, what sort of tree have you ever seen with its roots going up and its branches going down? Well, there is no such tree. But you may see it as a reflection of a real tree. So that's what this material world is. It's a reflection of the reality. And the reality is the spiritual realm. So Krishna is saying in the first few verses that we should understand, it's helpful to understand the material world in terms of its being like a reflection or like a banyan tree. And he describes different parts of the material world as if they're parts of the tree. And that's what is on these little sheets of paper that we passed out. So let's have a look at these little pieces of paper. The subjects which are described on this little piece of paper, they're found in the first two verses. But to simplify things, we've presented it in this form. So let us begin. The ground, what is the ground of the material world, or like the base of the whole thing, the cause? Desire. Everything is grounded in our desire. Then there is the main root, the one which is going up. So where is that located? It's in Brahmaloka, which is the topmost planet of this material realm. Or alternatively, Prabhupada says, it's rooted into the total material substance. Then there are other roots which go down. The main root is going up into the top levels of this material realm. The other roots are going down, and they're going into the human planetary systems, like here, in the forms of fruit of activities, attachment, aversion, all sorts of efforts, material efforts, which particularly go on this level. In the higher levels, generally people are not endeavoring so fruitively. They're enjoying the results of all their fruitive efforts. And in the lower planets, people are not really endeavoring fruitively. They're suffering the results of their fruitive activities on this level. But on this level, the middle planetary systems, this is where all the intense materialistic activity is going on. So these secondary roots, these other roots, they're rooted into the human planetary systems in the forms of various attachments and aversions. And from them come different sufferings and enjoyments. The branches of the different planetary systems, upper and lower, the leaves of the Vedic hymns, the twigs of the sense objects, the tips of the branches of the senses, the fruits are the results of one's activities, the results of one's dharma, artha, karma, and moksha. And what nourishes it all? What is feeding it and sustaining it? The modes. Now, we want you to learn this because this is for one question in our text.
you're going to have to be able to present what is on this piece of paper to understand the material world in terms of it being the banyan tree or the reflection of the banyan tree. So, we're all caught up here. And Krishna says in the third verse that you have to cut it down. How? Through detachment. As we've mentioned on so many occasions now, in yoga, the principal activity in yoga is detachment from this material world. That is a characteristic of all types of yoga, be they personal or impersonal or whatever they may be. Where there is detachment, then one can take it that this is a form of yoga. So you've cut down your attachment to this material world through with the weapon of detachment. Now Krishna makes an interesting point in that verse, 3 or 3 and 4, that you can't see the real form of this tree in this world because you're so caught up in it. There's a well-known saying in Western civilization that you can't see the forest for the trees. Some of you would have heard that. You're so deeply in the forest that you can't see the whole forest. You can't see the whole situation because you're caught up in the immediate situation in the middle of so many trees. So we are caught up in this material world. And we can't see the whole situation because we're so caught up and attached to and absorbed in the very immediate situation, our particular position in the forest of existence or in the banyan tree. The banyan tree is given here not just any sort of tree, because the banyan tree, sometimes banyan trees grow very big. And you can't really tell where does it begin, where does it end. One devotee told me about how there used to be a banyan tree, supposedly, which began halfway from here to Calcutta. It began. That's, I don't know, 60 or 70 kilometers away from here. And it began there. And then the same tree continued on till the boundary, the border of Calcutta. Delhi. Well, that makes it even more fantastic. Anyway, the idea is that a banyan tree can be very big, and it can be very hard to figure out what is really what, and how is it all working. So that's the idea here. But of course, we're being told about this tree in terms of it being a reflection. And wherever there's a reflection, it means that there must be a real tree. That's very important. In this way, Krishna is indicating the spiritual realm, that there is a spiritual realm. And that the spiritual realm looks very, very similar to this realm, almost exactly the same. But the spiritual realm is real, and this realm is just a reflection. The reflection, you know, if you have a tree, a reflection of a tree, and you see in the reflection, you see some nice fruit, and you think, oh, let me pick the fruit and eat it. So if you try and pick the fruit out of the reflection, you'll see there's nothing there. So it's like that. The material world looks very good, looks very promising. We can have a great time. Looks like it's got so many facilities. But when you try and grab hold of it and get something out of it, you see there's nothing there. Why does it look so good? Because it's a reflection of the real tree. And the real tree is very nice. Very, very nice, actually. But the reflection, it's simply superficial, and there's no substance to it whatsoever. So unfortunately, that's the position in material life. People are trying to draw something, some pleasure,
out of the reflection, but the reflection doesn't have the capacity to supply any pleasure or anything at all. There's nothing there, basically. So therefore we should turn to the real tree. And in verse 4, or the second half of the translation of verses 3 and 4, Krishna indicates the spiritual realm. And in verse 5 he does the same thing. He indicates the real thing. Verse 5 he points out that if you become purified, if you actually become detached and become free of all the inequities of material existence, then you can enter into the eternal kingdom. Particularly, if you know how to surrender. I thought it was rather nice yesterday, Hanumat Preshaka Swami was talking about how devotees come along and join ISKCON, and they say, like, here I am, I surrender. I'm surrendering to Krishna when they join the temple. Like, you know, when you've joined, that means you've surrendered. You're now the same surrendered soul that Krishna's talking about in Bhagavad Gita. Fully surrendered. But I think, as we all know, it's not quite that easy to surrender. There's a lot more to it than just saying, oh, I surrender. Like that. There's a lot more to it. You have to know how to surrender. Prabhupada referred to the process of surrender. He called it an adventure in surrender. An adventure. Meaning it's a whole thing you go through. It's mainly your mind, I guess, really. Work your way out of your conditioning and work your way out of your attachments. And try to become more attached to Krishna bit by bit. So you have to know how to surrender. That's why Krishna is giving this extra jnana here. So that we know how, like, to detach ourselves. What is the material world? In order to really detach yourself from the material world, you have to know what it is. Otherwise you can maintain attachments to it, but you won't be aware that you're attached. Like so many people think that to develop love for Krishna is the same thing as developing love for a member of the opposite sex. They think it's the same thing in so many cases. But that love, we all know, within this material world, that love is not really love, it's more lust. That we are looking at, people are looking at each other and within themselves they're thinking, what can I get from this?
The modes means a more detailed understanding of prakriti, and that we're going to get in the next chapter. Any last question from anyone? Tristan?
Eight.
Eight.
Explain that knowledge is not product of interaction of fields of activity.
Yeah, it's not a product of the interaction.
That means that knowledge is actually a product of spiritual energy?
Knowledge, real knowledge, yes. That's why constant and unalloyed devotion to Krishna has to be there. Otherwise you won't get knowledge. This is, Prabhupada said, this is the most important thing as far as the process of knowledge is concerned. Yeah, so it's a fact. It's not just a matter of the interactions of the field. How the material nature is working.
But if some normal people, I mean, not devotees, manifest some this quality, we can understand that this is also manifestation that they know.
It's like empty knowledge. Empty knowledge. You know, they may appear to be very humble and prideless, but if it's not connected with Krishna, it's really empty. Of course, if they become knowledgeable of Krishna, then that quality becomes nice. But otherwise, we wouldn't really recognize it as being a particularly wonderful thing.
But my question is, if this quality are not manifestation of three modes of material nature in case of, you know, not pure devotee, this quality,
Well, in case of people who are materialistic, yes. Humility would mean mode of goodness more. But in a devotee, we understand that these are transcendental. Particularly in a pure devotee, and in a devotee who's not a pure devotee but who is trying to become a qualified devotee, then these qualities, we would understand they're becoming